Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Puthang thamang sangkhang kunutarang upachayang namasami. Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to say a few words on the topic of friendship and noble friendship and Lumpu Cha as Kalyana Mitta. So I think it's somewhat surprising, given the emphasis in Theravada Buddhism on self-reliance and creating our own refuge, the central importance given to good and noble friendship, as expressed so famously in the words of the Lord Buddha to Venerable Ananda, say not so, Ananda. Kalyana Mitta is not just half of the holy life, it's the whole of the holy life. But also, in everyday life, the importance of good friendship is to be found in the very first lines of the Mangala Sutta. To have friendship with the good and the noble, and to avoid friendship with those who drag us down, who lead to a growth of defilements in our hearts. So in so many areas of life, the Buddha gave us this very useful standard when we decide to what degree we commit to a friendship, a relationship, an endeavor of any kind, then we determine whether overall there is a growth or a decrease in kusala dhammas, a growth or a decrease in akusala dhammas. And friendship is a clear example, an area of life in which we can use this principle. So I think we all know, we all have friends perhaps who are overall like really nice people, maybe people we've known since we were kids. And yet when we get together, there's this kind of toxic chemical reaction takes place. And we find it's easier to do unskillful things that alone we perhaps would not have done. We find it easier and almost natural to speak in unskillful ways. We find ourselves thinking in mean and unskillful ways. And we have to conclude, probably rather reluctantly, that as much as we love this person, or as much as we feel some affection towards this person, and then here's what we call a papa mitta, is someone whose company is not good for us. On the other hand, we all have friends, and I hope many of those of you in long-term relationships, marriages, can say this about your spouses, that they bring out the good in you, that you find it easier to do good things, easier, more natural to speak about good things. You find good thoughts, wholesome thoughts in your mind, and you conclude that I don't really know that alone or without the presence of this person in my life, whether I would be able to act as well as this, or whether I would be able to speak as well as this, or to have these kinds of thoughts, to have made this kind of merit, to accumulated this kind of barami. So this is the kind of friendship that I think we all seek and we all hope to find in our lives. And this friendship is taken to an even higher level in the case of the spiritual friend. And we call the Kalyana Mitta par excellence, figures such as Ajahn Chah. So in my studies of Buddhism before I became a monk, which were admittedly rather superficial, but I was not inspired by the model of a spiritual teacher as a guru or as a god figure. I was much inspired by the idea of a teacher who kept the same rules, had the same standard of sila as all of his disciples. I felt a system in which there was no conception of a kind of a crazy wisdom in which the enlightened being could not be held accountable for his actions or not held responsible in the way that a normal person or an unenlightened person could be for acts which would otherwise be criticized or considered immoral. So the idea that a great master, an arahant even, should keep all of the rules of the Vinaya in exactly the way that a young monk of a few days, a few months, a few pansas would. For me, this seemed to be to form the backbone of a training that I could trust and that I could commit my life to. So this was one of the reasons which I chose this particular school of Buddhism, and led me at the age of 20 to Wat Bapong in northeast Thailand. And over the years that I studied with Ajahn Chah, which were few, when I look at it, it was I arrived when Lumpo Cha was 60 years old, and I can remember thinking, oh, he's so old, and now I'm 60, and I thought, oh, what a foolish perception. But he was old, actually, for a 60-year-old, and he admitted himself that he'd aged, and he looked older than his age, I think, at that point in his life. And he would say, well, considering, you know, all that I put myself through when I was a young monk, then I'm just happy to still be around at all. So Lumpo Pasano has mentioned that we didn't speak Thai, he didn't speak English, but that I don't think any of us felt that was a particular problem, at least to begin with, because communication is not restricted to the content of the words that we speak, and that the feelings that we have, or the feelings that the student has towards the teacher, or indeed any listener has towards any speaker, condition to what extent any change takes place. Because as a monastic, then we are declaring that we are ready to abandon everything for this path to enlightenment, and that we trust this teacher that whatever he says and does will be ultimately for our benefit, even though at the time it might seem quite the opposite. And I think that whether it's myself or any of the other senior monks who were blessed enough to have practiced, have met and learned from Lumpo Cha, I think we all felt it was really his presence and his example and who he was, which was the most powerful teaching. In fact, the Dhamma teachings he gave were wonderful, certainly. But unlike many of our Thai friends and fellow Thai monks and novices, most of us had done quite a lot of reading before we arrived. And many of the things that Lumpo Cha taught us were not revolutionary, you know, not things that we'd never heard before in the most case, but they affected us. They're the things he said you remembered forever. I can say that, you know, no matter how much your memory, our memories, at least my memory, fades as I get older, the words that Ajahn Chah spoke to me will never fade. I know that. And this was because of the feelings that he could produce in his students, this feeling that this is somebody who is speaking from direct experience. He's not speaking from book knowledge. He's not speaking to impress or show off his knowledge. This is an effort on his part to transmit the Dhamma which he knows and sees within his heart. And so at the beginning, even with a few words of Thai, and he, to give him his due, would try to speak in very simple terms with his Western disciples, then you felt that every word was like a jewel. It was just a wonderful thing. And you say, like, pinch yourself. How could I be so fortunate? What good things have I done in my past to get me here? It's unbelievable. So as time went on, I began to appreciate the ways in which he seemed to me to embody the principle of the Kalyana Mitta as a spiritual teacher. And so in one of the suttas, the Buddha gives us a list of the qualities of the Kalyana Mitta, the true Kalyana Mitta. And when I read this, it's just like he's talking about Lumpo Cha. So the first quality is that the teacher, the Kalyana Mitta, inspires love and affection. You want to be around him. You want to be close to him. And In the old days, he would sit under his kuti at night and be chatting to the monks, and sometimes in a more informal way, sometimes telling stories, sometimes teaching the monks' discipline. And everybody would be sitting there, and nobody wanted to leave, even if you were tired and it was 11 o'clock at 12 o'clock at night. Basically, you wouldn't leave until you were kicked out, you know. And you just wanted to, it to last forever. You know, there's this sense that you just feel totally bereft when you left his presence. So this is not to say this is like a criteria of a great teacher, to say all teachers are like this. But this is one of the criteria which was very apparent in Lumpo Cha. So it's not like a checklist for arahants. And in fact, Lumpo himself said, when you see noble beings, it's like different species of bird. You know, they call it different sizes and colors and make different sounds, but they're all basically birds. And so you have charismatic arahants like Ajahn Chah. And then, yes, you can have grumpy arahants as well, you know, and it's going to have like voluble, articulate arahants and rather shy and inarticulate arahants. So this quality of Ajahn Chah was not, you know, a proof of anything, and it doesn't mean that monks who don't have that kind of magnetic quality are not arahants, but this was something that was very, to me, and I think to most others, very very strong feature of who he was. And his brother said to me, this is a long time ago in the 1980s, and he said to me, it's not like he's really handsome, but when he's in the room, you just can't take your eyes off him. Yeah. So, and I said, yeah, that's the definition of charisma, isn't it? So there's this kind of warmth and affection, love that you feel, we felt for Ajahn Chah. But for any Kalyana Mitta in a leadership position, to be the abbot of a monastery or of any kind of organization, that lovableness has to be balanced by the second quality, and that's the quality of that he inspires respect. So if you look at this picture up here, that for me, what's your immediate emotion when you look at that picture? That piece doesn't, for me, inspire a sense of love and what you like. Think, oh, you know, I feel respect, and I feel a little bit kind of fear, actually. Excuse me, speaking about myself again, but I had this personality. I can't remember ever being afraid of another human being. I mean, I've been afraid of physical violence when I was a teenager and going to football matches and things like that, but not of ever afraid of any authority figure. And yet I found myself really afraid of Ajahn Chah. And even though, you know, I'm sitting in front of a man who hasn't even killed a mosquito in his life, you know, 40 years, and yet there's something about him, some kind of elemental quality, something like, in the presence of a mountain or a huge waterfall or something like this. There's something that's kind of, it creates a distance. So you have that with the lovable side of Ajahn Chah, you have this sense of connection and intimacy. And at the same time with this respect-inspiring deportment and his personality, then there's this balance with a little bit of distance. So you have a sense of intimacy and distance. And if there's only the lovable side of a teacher, a parent, then sometimes the students can forget themselves a little bit. and get a little bit too, try to get too close or feel too close. It's not good for the student, maybe not good for the teacher. But he was able to produce a sense of respect and awe. And you know, the sense of, how can someone do that? You know, it just takes your breath away. And just it's that sense of respect, that he could live his life like that, that he could practice like that. And he was somebody who always led from the front. He's not someone who just said, do it like this, do it like that. And he goes back and has a rest. You know, he does it. He's there leading. And he does it more than you could do, more than you could ever hope to do, and better than you can do. And you look at him for any signs of greed and jealousy and anger and irritation and confusion, and you look again and you look again, and there's one part of you that doesn't want to look because you just want to hold him up and look at him as being perfect. And there's another part of you, you can't help. You just want to see, that is there actually some kind of blemish or flaw in this diamond, you know, and you can't help yourself looking. No. And this, you just, no. No. Is that, and this is how this sense of respect and awe builds up, you know. How can a human being be like that? You know, it's just like it's a different level. And you know, and I wrote this poem, and I said, when I met him, it's like you lived in a universe that only has plastic flowers, and then one day you see a real flower. Oh, that's what a flower is. You didn't even know that there was such a distinction between plastic flowers and real flowers until you met a real flower. Or if you only ever heard carrot. I don't know whether this simile works, but bear with me. If you only ever heard like karaoke singers, and then, you know, you heard an opera singer, oh, well, that's what singing is, you know. It's like, you know, it's a sense, this is just a whole different league. It's a whole different way of being a human being. It's just beyond anything that you recognize that you can conceive. So this is the kind of feelings that of respect, and you know, he's a leader, and just in so many areas, in terms of I mentioned before, in his practice of the Vinaya, you know, you get a bit older, and you know, like me, a bit sloppy in this and sloppy in that. No, he was always, his robe was always beautifully rolled, and he was always a model of decorum and correctness in his posture and his movement and his sitting down and his getting up. And it's just respect. And the more that you try to practice, and the more you realize how tough it is and how difficult it is to deal with defilements, and how beautiful and how noble the Kusala Dhammas are, and then you see in him this freedom from these Akusala Dhammas, and the beauty of the Kusala Dhammas in him is like a vessel for Kusala Dhammas, that is this sense of great respect. And the next quality is that he inspires you to emulate him. This is the quality of a teacher. And one of the skillful means that Lumbuchar employed, and a feature of his Dhamma talks, in all of his Dhamma talks, he didn't talk about himself very much. You know, it took months and years combing through the Dhamma talks that he'd given to find the odd biographical detail. When I was researching for the original Thai biography, it's a long, long time, and you finally find a 5-minute anecdote, a story, and it's, wow, you know, this goes straight in the book, you know. So But when he did talk about himself, it tended to be about his difficulties, his problems, his weaknesses as a young monk. And it was obvious that he was very keen on reminding his students that he started off where we were all starting off. He wasn't this kind of pure being that was encased in a halo from birth. He'd been naughty and he'd been stupid and he'd done things that maybe not so skillful as a boy and a young man and as a young monk. He struggled with sexual desire and he struggled with all kinds of things. But his message was not that I'm a special figure who has just so much barami and just look up to me and bow. His thing was, look, I've been all through all these things that you're going through, and you may not think that there's an end to them, but there is. I've been through them. And Lumpur Pasano said earlier, he said, it's because I was willing to dare. I was glad, he had this warrior mentality. He's just going to stick with it. And he said this willing to bear with the ups and downs, the vicissitudes of practice, and just keep consistent practice and working away at it, and being patient and being diligent and never giving in to doubts and indecision. He said this is what kept him going, and eventually this kind of vigor and commitment and integrity and sincerity together, combined with the practice of mindfulness and the power of samadhi, resulted in this maturity that allowed the liberating wisdom to appear in his mind. So it's someone who was inspired you to believe that you could do it. He inspired you to try it out and put it to the test. And he inspired you to do things that you didn't think you could do. And this is, I think, the sign of a teacher. Takes you beyond the limitations that you create for yourself out of your own fears and self-doubt and say, yeah, you can do this. Really, you can. So he was great. This is the fourth quality. He's a great communicator. Even when you don't speak his language, he doesn't speak your language. He's communicating something that you never forget. But of course, some of you may be familiar when he was, well, how do you teach all these Westerners? Do you speak English? Do you speak Japanese? Do you speak German? And he said, no. And how do you teach all these people? And he said, your house, do you have cows? Yes. Do you have buffaloes? Yes. Do you have chickens? Yes. Do you have dogs? Yes. Well, do you speak cow language? Do you speak buffalo language? And I say, no. He said, well, yeah. Well, how? That's how, these Westerners, he says, just like water buffalo, you put a ring through the nose and you just pull them this way and you pull them that way. They sooner or later, they get the hang of it. So it's not teaching like teaching on a university course. It's training, and the teaching in terms of the content is one part of that for sure, but it's the training. And it's that making you suffer. That's the most compassionate thing you can do. When you have certain safeguards and moral standards which are fixed in stone, and then you make people suffer so that they can see that suffering is caused by samudaya. You can only see suffering is like a stream. You can only see it when you go against the stream. If you're flowing along with the stream, can you tell how fast the stream is? No, you can, but you can soon tell when you go against the stream. So this was a principle of the way he trained people, and he communicated not just verbally, but in the way that he created his monastery, the training that he created. These were all speaking to you. These were all communicating the path of practice. Look right now, like Lumpur was saying, is this suffering? Yeah, it is. Well, why? Well, if I'm suffering, then there must be Kama Tanha, Bhava Tanha, Vipava Tanha. There must be ignorance. Where is that? What's going on here? So this is this call to look and to learn and to observe from what's from your experience in your day-to-day life. And he said, you know, I can't speak all these foreign languages, but I can speak the language of civil servants, I can speak the language of soldiers, I can speak the language of rice farmers, I can speak so many languages. So he had this ability to adapt his teaching to the level of knowledge and the interests and the backgrounds of the people that he spoke to, and to the individual personalities and dispositions of the people he spoke to, in a most wonderful way. And many of us remember being astounded how he could be sitting with many different groups at the same time and be switching from one to the other effortlessly, and changing the language, even the language between Central Thai and Northeastern dialect, and the tone and the similes and the metaphors and the feeling, and just it's quite wonderful to see how he could do that in such a spontaneous way. So how was he able to do that? Because he had realized this, and so it was an application of something. It's just a flowing out of something that was there naturally. And he said, if the Dhamma is speaking from in your heart, it's like a stream that never runs dry. But if you're speaking from memory, then you have periods where, you know, you can't speak, or you become self-conscious, or it doesn't work. But when there is that contact with the Dhamma, and then there's just this effortless flow, and you could see that in him so clearly. So the next quality is patient. He's patient. In the sutta, it speaks specifically of patience towards the speech of students. But I think we can include this, like the emotions and the perceptions. And, you know, as a teacher, people are projecting so many different things onto you all of the time, some of them more accurate than others. And there are expectations and hopes and fears, and it's quite tiring and exhausting. And as a leader of any kind of a teacher, then you're always seeing much more of the picture. Like someone on the top of a mountain, you can see 360 degrees. Someone on the side of the mountain can only see one slice of the mountain. But we all tend to believe that our slice of the mountain is the whole mountain. And so this leads to conflicts, and sometimes there are jealousies amongst students, who's closer to the teacher, who's closest to the teacher, and all these kind of things that go on. And Lumpur, in every area of his life, showed this patient endurance, and it was this forbearance and willing to, in Lumpur Sumedho's wonderful phrase, I was able to peacefully coexist with the unpleasant, whether it was physical or mental and environmental. And so he had this wonderful quality of patience, and he wasn't going to give up on you just because you were silly and petty and got confused or made mistakes. He was patient with you. Because he really wanted you to see this and to do this. He was able to, this is the sixth of the seventh qualities. So I'm running out of time now, so I have to accelerate. He was able to explain the most profound topics in a very simple language. So we often confuse complexity with profundity, don't we? You know, somebody, you read something, you hear something, and you say, oh, that was so profound. What you really mean is, I couldn't understand a word. But he, you know, being part of him, being a great communicator, you know, this obviously connected, he was able to take these profound topics of Dhamma and explain them in a simple way. But to quote another a Western figure, as simple as they could be explained, but no simpler. Sometimes there's this kind of making a fetish out of simple explanations to the extent that the simple explanation doesn't do full justice to the complexity of the original, because some things are complex. You can't make every complex thing into a simple thing. But he was able to grasp the essential elements and to summarize or to point to the most important distinctions that needed to be made, and masterful use of simile and metaphor to illustrate his understanding of Dhamma. So it wasn't just that he could speak in a very simple way without using a lot of very difficult words and concepts, but that the simplicity did no harm to, did not in any way distort the profundity that he was referring to. This was his genius. Lastly, he was someone who never led his students away from the Dhamma, whether it's into distraction or into wrong views. He was never gave bad example. He never abused his power, his authority. If you think about it, if you're someone with his charisma, his personal magnetism in whatever mode of life, in whatever environment, he would have been an important person for sure. And added to or intensified by that natural power and charisma and awe-inspiring nature, he had all of the barami of the robe and of the yellow robe. And this is like a powerful piece of cloth. You know, this is like 2,500 years of barami in this simple robe, and in his position as an abbot, and in his reputation as a great monk or even an arahant. Basically, he could very easily have taken advantage of anybody he wanted to, and he never did, even once, in any kind of way, even in the most trivial of ways. And this is one of the great marvels that we found in Ajahn Chah. So this isn't a kind of a kind of academic, even-handed presentation. This is a presentation of a fan. This is a presentation of someone who loved and respected Ajahn Chah as if he was my father, and indeed he was my father. He was my upajaya, and I myself and all the rest of the monks who spent time at Wat Pa Phong, you know, just feel this great sense of gratitude and joy to have had the immense good fortune to have been his disciples and to be his disciples. And we're all very happy to be able to share some of our enthusiasm with all of you today. So I'd like to end my talk at this point.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.